Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like in the world's coldest places, and what might we lose if we can't keep them from warming? Paul Nicklin's passion for polar wildlife began when he was 4 years old, and his parents moved to a small Inuit village on Canada's Baffin Island. As one of only a handful of non-Inuit kids in the settlement, Nicklin was taught to read the weather, respect the wildlife, and to see the frozen landscape as something to be embraced and explored rather than feared. That early indoctrination continues to serve him today in his award-winning work as a photographer. He spends about 9 months of every year living and working at the planet's poles in an effort to document the amazing creatures that thrive in these harsh environments and to communicate just how vulnerable they are to the ravages of global warming. Paul Nicklin is a wildlife photographer for National Geographic and other magazines. His new book is called Polar Obsession, and he is in town to speak at the Brinker International Forum Series tonight at the AT&T Performing Arts Center in Dallas. By the way, you can find a link to his work online at the Think page of KERA.org. Paul, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
So you began your professional life as a biologist. You had no formal photography training. What convinced you that you could do more for these threatened ecosystems with photography than with science?
I think what happened was after biology, I was really excited to, you know, get out in the field. After I finished my degree, get out in the field and work with these animals and you know, just be out there with polar bears, tagging them and putting satellite collars on them. And we'd work so hard. Sometimes we'd be in the field for 4 or 5 months and have these incredible experiences. And, you know, you'd see white wolves eating bearded seals on the sea ice. You'd see a mother polar bear showing her three cubs how to catch a seal in the seal holes. It was amazing. And then we'd get back to the office, and all we'd have for all that research that we did was a stack of paper. And then there would be, you know, maybe some infighting in our offices, or we wouldn't share the data with other scientists, and other scientists wouldn't share their data with us. And it just seemed like we worked really, really hard to have little impact. But the science was very, very important. And I often find that the best scientists that I work with are often the most intellectual and sometimes not the best communicators, but they're great at what they do. So I thought, as I was working out there in the field, I was already a photographer, I already loved photography, I was already dabbling in thinking about going full-time professional. And I finally thought, you know what, if I can bridge the gap between this incredible scientific research that they're doing and the public, and hopefully the dream would be to get into a magazine like National Geographic magazine, where now the one story that you just told can reach 40 million readers. And then I thought, there I can have an impact with the work I'm doing. So that's what was driven more by telling these important stories about the research we were trying to do on these animals in the polar regions.
Talk a little bit about growing up on Baffin Island.
Wow. It was an incredible experience. I, you know, moving from Saskatchewan when I was 3.5, 4 years old, and we arrived, and right away you're a minority as soon as you get off that airplane, and that was new. And we had no telephone, we had no TV, we didn't have anything. You know, we'd had no toilet. We had, you know, everything was a honey bucket. You know, you went to the bathroom in a bucket, and we got our groceries once a year on the ship. Came in and dropped the sea lift on the beach, and so the Inuit right away became my playmates, my best friends, and they also, without really knowing it at the time 4, 5, 6, 7 years old, they became my teachers. And you realized, you know, the sand and the ice were my sandbox, and they were, you know, all the time that you're out there on the ice, you're learning these skills from the Inuit, and they're teaching you how to survive and how to read ice, even though you're a young kid, you know, that you can walk on freshly new sea ice that's an inch thick. And also it's funny to grow up with the lore and the stories you know, things like Kalupilu, the sea monster that would come and eat you if you got too close to the sea ice. And it was a way that the Inuit would tell us these stories to keep the kids safe. They didn't want us playing on thin ice or going too close to the cracks in the ice. So they said, if you go too close, Kalupilu will show up wearing her amauti, which is a big parka with a big hood, and she'll take you and stuff you in her hood, take you down underwater, drown you, and eat you. And the hunters would come back from their trips and show me, you know, the hands and say, we were attacked today, and we were able to cut her hand off. She almost flipped the boat, the sea monster, but what they were really showing me was a rotten old seal flipper that they had found in their nets. And so it was really exciting times, just great visuals. And when you don't have all of these distractions of modern-day society, and I worry about kids nowadays with cell phones and Blackberries and computers and texting, their world is sort of looking at this little screen where there's this whole great natural world all around them. And, you know, it's tough for me to try and convince people to care about the habitat around them and talk about climate change when they're not exposed to it anymore. So it's for me, it's an obvious that I'm going to be obsessed with this because it was my full-time playpen being outside.
And a lot of the work that you do requires this extraordinary patience. Like, you'll sit there for weeks in a blizzard just waiting for an hour of really good shooting time.
Right, and it's and that's what I love about it most. People think that's often the worst part, but if I'm up on Baffin Island, you know, 3,000 miles north of Montreal, and sitting there on the ice floe, on the ice edge, waiting for narwhals to come by, I'll wait for a month before the whales will show up. And you're sitting there, and it's minus 20. And it's fascinating to hear all of it talked around town today about how cold it is. And I think for me, this might turn out to be my summer holiday. But yeah, to be out there on the sea ice waiting for the whales. And it's that sort of meditative state of waiting that I love so much. It's I love not having any distractions, no computer, no BlackBerry, no one phoning me. And, you know, the satellite phone just stays off all the time. And you just sit and the silence is almost deafening. Or if you listen to the beauty of a storm come in and the wind howling across the ice or across your tent. We don't keep any heat in our tents, and it's just you just sort of become in tune with the environment around you. And so I don't mind waiting for 3 weeks. I will wait literally 1 month for one good hour of photography, and I like that process.
What do you think about while you're waiting?
I don't know. I think as a photographer, as a visual artist, I'm constantly thinking about the images I want to make, and I'm constantly analyzing the light. And that brings me back to my childhood, where I'd sit on a hillside for hours every day just watching the shadows play light games across the sea ice or the mountainsides. And I'll still do that. And before I go in the field, before I go on an assignment, there's a lot of pressure on an assignment. You need to have the confidence that you can make these images, world-class images, and bring them back to the editors of National Geographic and not get fired. So you there's a lot of pressure. And so before I go in the field, I'll actually storyboard and sketch all the images that I want to make. And so, but while I'm out there on the ice waiting, I'll be open to other ideas, and I'll have this image in my mind, and maybe there's a really bad blizzard, just a lot of fog and snow and rain and wind just ripping across the ice. But it's the shot I want to make, waiting for that polar bear to come like a ghost out of that mist across the ice, sea ice. So rather than sitting there in my tent thinking, oh, the weather's bad, I'm just going to hunker down, I'll be out there waiting in the elements for that moment to happen because I storyboarded it. And so I'm always thinking about what's the next image that I can make that'll help tell this story that hopefully will make people care about the melting sea ice.
I think the storyboarding is really interesting because a lot of people would imagine that you make preparations with your gear and with what you're going to wear and what you're going to eat while you're out there, but you actually want to know how these animals are likely to behave when you encounter them so that you can imagine the best way to capture them.
Right. And I think that's, again, another blessing from my childhood is with gaining all this experience while living with the Inuit that, if you took a photographer from Dallas or New York and stuck them up there on the sea ice, they would spend 90% of their time trying to stay warm, and just survive.
Stay alive.
You know, an Inuit hunter put raw seal meat in front of them saying, eat, it's good, it's warm. They'd be running for their power bars and, cold all the time. And so that's great to have that skill. And getting back to your question, what that allows me is to really free up my mind visually and just to sit and wait and watch for those moments that are going to come by as opposed to trying to worry about taking care of myself. And so it's about, visualizing the moments.
So I want to talk about your underwater work. First of all, how do you manage to dive under sea ice without getting hypothermia?
Another great question, Chris. It's a really fine balance, and you know, I've just been reading these stories about the Alaskan crab fishermen and about how, they're in the water for 3 days straight and how they get hypothermia and the stages they go through, and it's very similar to the work I do. When I go in the water, I know I'm going to freeze. I know exactly sort of the process of how I'm going to get cold, and then I have to monitor my body life signs while I'm down working, because you can get so carried away with the work you're doing that you can get hypothermic if it's a really great shooting situation. So when you jump in the water initially, I wear a wet hood, so it means water gets underneath it, and it's so cold. The water is in Fahrenheit, is 29 Fahrenheit, as cold as seawater can get before it freezes. And if people can understand getting an ice cream headache where you get that sore spot, over your eye or on your head, I get that over my entire head, and it lasts about 5 minutes, to the point that I sometimes vomit into my regulator because it's just the way my body reacts to it. You clean out which is dangerous under the ice to be vomiting into your regulator, your breathing apparatus. So I clean it out and I keep going, and that's the first cold snap, and then you lose feeling in your lips. And that's about 5 minutes in. Then you lose feeling in your hands, which is about 10 minutes. And after 15 minutes, you lose all feeling in your feet, generally. And after that, after about 25 minutes to 30 minutes, you're still working. Things are numb. You have to look at your hand to see what it's actually doing because you can't feel it anymore as you're taking pictures with your housing. And so now that the pain's gone, it's very painful to get to that state, but you just put up with it because you want to make these pictures. And then now after about half an hour to 40 minutes, you start to shiver. And I'd say after 45 minutes to 50 minutes, I'm starting to shiver violently. And into the hour and 10 minutes, that's when I start to cramp up, and that's when it gets really dangerous. When you can know your shivering stops, you start to cramp. It's hard to kick. It's hard to work, and that's when you start to enter the hypothermic state. And I've been there quite a few times. So then when I come to the surface, you know, you get back to your hole, and people drag you onto the ice and give you something hot, pour hot water in your suit and your hands, feed you seal meat or feed you whatever to help trying to warm you up again. And I try not to get there because it is. You do that. You can do 1 hour like that in a day, and you're wasted. It feels like you've probably been in a football game. You're beat up, and so you only try and do that once a day. So it's better to do 30-minute dives, 40-minute dives on the outside, because you can get into a lot of trouble if you push it.
I think most people are familiar with the experience of being underwater, what it sounds like and what you can see. How is that different when there's a layer of ice above the water?
How is it different? The sounds wouldn't be any different. It's just so beautiful. I mean, the places where I'm diving are, you have 10 feet of blue ice over you, 10 feet thick of this multi-year ice. The visibility can be up to 500 feet. And so in the auditorium, the AT&T Center where I'm speaking tonight, I could see that entire situation like that if it was underwater. So if you can imagine these amphitheaters of ice and columns of ice and this multi-year ice, the pressure ridges and the cracks, and then you can hear the sounds are what really get me, though. It's the, you know, hearing the, which is the, you know, a bearded seal, and that's going on constantly. They're making this mating call, and then you've got the squeals of the beluga whales coming, and then you can hear the song of a bowhead whale in the distance, and sounds just really carry very well in that really cold, rich Arctic water. And it's, and then, you know, that's just the visuals. And then your other senses, you look up at the bottom of the ice and you see gazillions of amphipods coming by, and then you've got beluga whales coming through, and you see the Arctic cod, and you see this whole life ecosystem connected to the sea ice. And it really is sensory overload for me. And that's where it gets dangerous, is because you're so into it. Now you're not monitoring, you know, I'm not monitoring my air supply sometimes as well as I should, and I've almost run out a few times. And so you just got to be careful not to get too carried away with how beautiful it is down there.
Did it take you a while to learn how far away things were based on their sounds?
Yeah, I still can't do it.
Right.
I think that a bowhead whale's right there singing, and that whale might be 10 miles away, or you don't really know. But you can hear animals when they get closer. You can hear the belugas start to come, and they're getting louder, and you know what they're echoing. You can hear them clicking. It's like, and that would be a narwhal, and you know that they're focusing in on you with their echolocation underwater, and it gets really exciting. And you sort of start to look, and it's like the movie Abyss, where it's just you're looking into this black abyss of 3,000 feet deep, and all of a sudden you see the glow coming. There's a glow, and all of a sudden it gets really bright, and there they are, you know, a pod of, say, 10 narwhals or 10 beluga whales as they come up to you, and there they are, and it's just, and then the sounds and the clicks just go crazy once they see you, because they're just trying to figure out what you are. And the trick with beluga whales is you swim away from them as fast as you can. And
yeah, I can imagine.
You're trying to get pictures of them. So, mm-hmm. But they're a cautious animal. So if you swim towards them, they'll go away right away. Mm-hmm. But you take off as fast as you can, act like you're scared. It drives them crazy. And they chase you, and that's what you want. They chase you down, and they try and stop you. And they kind of corral you, and they'll go off and get their buddies and bring back more beluga whales and start to circle you. And that's when you can start taking your pictures. So you have to. It's fun to figure out the dynamics with these animals and the behavior.
Paul Nicklin is my guest. He's a photographer for National Geographic. His new book is called Polar Obsession. He's in town to speak at the Brinker International Forum Lecture Series tonight at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can find information about that at attpac.org. If you want to see pictures as we speak of Paul Nicklin's photography, you can go to paulnicklin.com. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is photographer Paul Nicklin. He shoots for National Geographic and other publications. His new book is called Polar Obsession, and he's in town to speak at the Brinker International Forum Lecture Series tonight at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Do you think of yourself as a danger junkie?
I actually really try not to have that reputation because, you know, National Geographic magazine, they have insurance on us. And when we're out there working, you don't want to be seen as a liability. And you want them to trust you that you're going to come back with the story. But, yeah, I mean, unfortunately, over the last 3 years, I've had enough close calls, especially in the last 2 years, that they're all making jokes about it at Geographic. I think they just introduced me to Talking DC as Gonzo or something like that. When you get a nickname for being sort of I shouldn't say a cowboy because we're in cowboy country, but I mean, I'm pushing the limits. But that's the work I do. I mean, I've crashed 2 ultralights in the last year and a half alone and just ended upside down in a lake in my airplane, got busy thinking about photography and had my wheels down on my floats. And so 60 miles an hour, I'm on my back and trying to crawl out of the cockpit. So that was, you know, situations like that and almost getting crushed by an elephant seal because I dropped the ball and did something no one else had done before, just swimming up to a big breeding bull in the surf zone and you know, having leopard seals feed me penguins. And, you know, but I get so caught up with these images trying to get people to realize that the ice is this connected ecosystem and that all these animals depend on a healthy ice. So if people say we're just losing ice, well, it's not. If we lose ice, we stand to lose a whole ecosystem. And if I take a picture of just a big fat elephant seal, you know, sitting on the beach with his big proboscis, his big nose looking all ugly, that's not going to make people go, oh, wow, I care about the polar regions. But if you can make it look elegant and beautiful in the water where it's truly a graceful creature, then I have a better chance of getting people to care. And say, you know, leopard seals are the villain in all these movies. And in Happy Feet, it's the villain. And March of the Penguins, it's the villain. So, again, if I can get in and show it as this nurturing, caring animal that feeds me penguins and wants to take care of me and it's super intelligent, then it's there's a chance that people are going to appreciate those species and realize that, you know, if we lose ice, we stand to lose those leopard seals and elephant seals and polar bears. So I'm putting myself in danger because I do get so into what I'm doing, just really trying to shoot those powerful images. Because when someone picks up National Geographic magazine, they're sitting in the doctor's office, you know, bored. There's no guarantee that they're going to read my story. It's my job as a journalist to shoot the best pictures I can to try and lure them into my story. If I can have a wow image, it's the lead image in the story. They look at a bear eating a seal, something they haven't seen before, and they go, wow. Maybe they read the captions. Maybe they go back and read the whole story. And then I'm doing my job as a journalist.
Let's talk about that leopard seal story. First of all, describe for people who haven't seen Happy Feet what a leopard seal looks like.
A leopard seal is an animal that is the large females. Females are big. They're bigger. They have sexual dimorphism. So the females are about 20-30% bigger, 12 feet long, 1,000 pounds. They have these black, sinister-looking eyes, reptilian heads, serpentine-like bodies, and they're covered in they're a silver seal with these black spots all over them, given their name, the leopard seal. Plus, they're with a huge set of teeth, really big teeth. So the head would be as big as a grizzly bear's head. And since the time of Shackleton, they've been this seal that pursues people. They just are coming up to people on the ice. A couple people have been attacked. Sadly, a researcher was killed in 2003 when she was taken down and drowned by a seal. They love to bite zodiacs when tourists are in them. They like to puncture the pontoons so people think they're being attacked. So there's just this seal that has this bad reputation, and they are a little bit scary looking. And their one threat display that they do to people in boats or to people on the ice is they love to open up their mouths as wide as they can. And they don't hiss, but they make like a – it would be like almost if a big snake was hissing at you. So they do have this intimidating appearance.
And they blow bubbles at you.
They blow bubbles underwater, which is a threat display in the animal world.
So you decided, okay, I'm going to have to get in and get inches away from one of these things.
Well, I have two friends, Goran Elma from Sweden and Doug Allen and Shane Moore, three friends I worked with who are filmmakers for BBC. And they said to me that they had been in the water with them. And I said, well, do you think it's possible to do a story, you know, for a National Geographic story? And to shoot a whole expose on this creature underwater would mean getting in the water with them dozens of times to get these good – because shooting a good picture is very hard. You need hundreds of chances to really get a good shot. So I said, you know, I can't just jump in the water and get one quick picture and call it a story. I said, I need to be intimate and close to these animals. Is it possible? Are they dangerous? And they said, you know what, with their experiences, they explained that they had never really a scary moment with them, and they thought they were just curious, wonderful seals. So I asked Godan from Sweden to come with me, be my guide, And so we went off to Antarctica, and I said, what I want to do is get in the water with as many leopard seals as I could over a one-month period. Never, you know, I don't want to approach the animal and change its behavior. All I was trying to do was get in the vicinity of that seal and have it swim to me. If it, I mean, with, once you're in the animal, in the water's realm, and once you're in the water, you're very vulnerable to that animal. It can attack you or it can leave you. So it's in control of the encounter. So that's what I wanted to do, just jump in the water with as many seals as I could.
And the one that was feeding you penguins, first of all, when they take a penguin, they basically sort of shake their heads really violently so that they can, as you write, turn them inside out.
Right. So the first encounter was that we had, I had no idea how big, I'd never seen a leopard seal before, but we came into this bay and Gordon said, you know, he goes, you know, that's the biggest leopard seal I've ever seen. And it was this massive female. She came up to the boat with the penguin in her mouth. She jammed it under the hull of the boat, lifting the boat out of the water, the hull of the bow of the boat. We had to sit down and brace ourselves. Then she swam off about 10 feet and started to rip it apart. And she's doing what you're explaining, whipping it from side to side, and what they're trying to do is turn the penguins inside out to get rid of the feathers and the skin so they can eat the meat. And then so there's blood everywhere in the water, and that's when Godon says to me, it's time for you to get in the water, yeah. You know, and so I was quite nervous about it. And I was, you know, I said, forget that, I'm not getting in. You know, it's, I said, I'll do it tomorrow. And he goes, it's 10 a.m., you've been complaining about failing the story and losing your career. And he goes, I'm guiding you, here's your seal, you know, shut up and get in the water. And so I became more scared of him and of Gordon, and I slipped into the water, and yeah, right away there she was, blowing bubbles and opened up her mouth doing these huge threat displays. Her head's bigger than a grizzly bear's, and she came, you know, right up to me. Her upper canines are on top of my head, and her lower canines are below my chin. I'm looking down inside the throat of the seal. And Gordon said, you know, if you get scared, make sure you just close your eyes and she'll go away. And so the truth in that is the more I kept shooting, the more the shutter was black on the camera. Mm-hmm. And so the less I could see, being a single SLR camera. And so that was the initial encounter I had with the seal.
How do you decide when it makes sense to stand up to your fears and to ignore them, and when it makes sense to listen to what your heart is telling you to do?
I think with all animals, you have to assess every situation completely differently. When you look at a leopard seal, they don't have any scars on them. They're scarless animals. So they're not biting each other to communicate. If you look at a crab-eater seal, a much smaller seal with a much smaller mouth, they're covered in scars, and they're constantly biting each other. There's always blood on the ice when they're around each other. And you look at walrus, they communicate by hitting each other all the time. If you're too close, they hit each other. A walrus comes up to me, it tests me by hitting me. Leopard seals have all of these beautiful built-in threat displays that they do. And you can tell by watching it right away that the threat was never really aggressive. I never felt like I was being attacked. She came up actually very gently and just opened up her mouth as wide as she could, came right up to me. And then she did it again and again. And it was just very beautiful and graceful how she did it, actually. It was, you know, but if the seal was chomping and, you know, trying to get my leg, or then you go, okay, this is an erratic seal. It's not comfortable. But she's in control of the situation. And so the trick with these big predators, whether it's a bear or a seal, is to never act aggressive and never act scared. And it's tricky sometimes to not act scared when you know, looking down the throat of a seal. And it's just to try and stay calm and keep giving your calm energy to this animal. Just keep exuding this calmness. And hopefully, and then within 2 minutes of her threat display, she totally relaxed, just stopped doing them. And she went off and started to feed me penguins. And this went on for 4 days, off and on for 4 days. Whenever I was in the neighborhood, I would come by in the boat. She'd come racing over. And if I slipped in the water, she'd go off and get me a penguin and bring it to me. So she spent, after those threat displays, after I gave her the benefit of the doubt, she tried to feed me penguins for 4 days.
Did you think about taking one from her?
I did. Not really. I was just so in awe of the photographic opportunities. Again, you have to. I would love to sometimes just put my camera down and watch what's going on in disbelief, but you have to work. And so, you know, the whole time I'm just thinking of compositions and shooting the pictures. And I mean, if I wasn't crying in my mask because it was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen as a photographer, then I was laughing so hard that my mask was filled with water. So when you laugh, you get the, you know, the crinks on the side of your eyes, and the water's flooding, and I'd have to clear my mask because she's just flipping penguins on top of my head, and you could tell she was frustrated that I wasn't accepting them. She'd go off and get me other ones, and she would eat them, and just I was just in disbelief. So yeah, I never thought I could have taken one, I guess, but I didn't want to wreck the chemistry that we already had. It was an incredible dynamic that we had between the two of us, so I didn't want anything to change, so I just kept shooting.
Is there something about the danger that enhances the beauty for you?
I love it. I mean, I love the danger. I think, you know, they say to have true adventure, you have to really be almost willing to die. And I love that vulnerability of getting in the water with a big predator like that. Or, you know, I've jumped in the water with killer whales, you know, that could just rip you apart in seconds. And I love I love that. I mean, I guess for someone who climbs Everest, it must be, or a K2 or some major mountain where you're putting it all on the line to really taste life. And when I come out of those encounters with that leopard seal, you know, I was buzzing for, I didn't sleep for 4 nights after that first encounter. And then it has stayed fresh in my mind ever since those 4 days we had together. And that was 3 years ago. And by far the best encounter I've ever had. And anytime I'm really close to an animal like that, I get this, I've never done drugs, but or have been, you know, sort of used any chemicals in my life, but it's got to be, you know, the high that I get. I can't imagine that there's a higher high in the world than experiencing that level of vulnerability, fear, and yet accomplishment, yet, you know, connectedness to this species. And sort of having this interspecies communication, for me, it's as good as it gets. And it's what fuels me to do what I do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Paul Nicklin. Let's go first to Alan in Dallas. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Alan.
Alan from, how are you today?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm looking forward to seeing some of your pictures. When you described your acclimatization to the cold when you're diving, it sounded like you're wearing a wetsuit instead of a dry suit. I wonder if that's true and if there's a reason for that.
That's a great question, Alan. No, actually, I am wearing a very, very good dry suit, and it's made by my friend in Sweden. It's by Waterproof, and it's this very thick dry suit. And that's what you're trying to do, is to keep your body core warm. And unfortunately, with this dry suit, I wear a wet hood and I wear wet gloves. I've tried dry hoods and dry gloves, and if you get a leak in either a dry glove or a dry hood, you really run the risk of getting hypothermia faster. So it's just better to let your hands and your head get wet and go numb. But the key is to keep your body core warm, and that's why you get blood shunting or bradycardia, and that's why you lose feelings in your hands and arms and feet, because all that blood is now coming to the core of your body, and that's the area you're trying to keep warm. So a dry suit is very important. You couldn't do what I do in a wetsuit. You would, especially after coming out of the dive and changing at minus 20 with a blizzard on the ice, you would have other hypothermic issues.
Talk to me a minute about camping on the ice, because you've had to move your tent multiple times because you realized that the ice was cracking and you're about to drift out to sea.
Right. We camp on a place called the Flow Edge, and this is where, even in the winter, this ice meets the open water. And if it's really cold in the winter, that ice extends away from land, and in the summer that ice comes closer to land into the fjords. So, but you want to be in the line of action, so you are on this edge where water meets ice. That's where all the animals are coming by, so you want to be as close as you can. But that ice is sometimes only 6 inches or a foot thick. And so every time a new swell, the water comes underneath the ice, you get the swell, you get cracks in the ice, and then you get this really strong outgoing current that peels that ice off and goes out to sea. So we'll move our camp, our tent, sometimes 3 times in a day. You know, normally is once every 2 days we have to move our tent, because we're doing this photography in the spring. The ice is breaking up all the time, so you're always moving back to safer and safer ice. I've had been caught in my worst situation where I actually drifted out to sea for 2 miles on a piece of ice, broke off from the main pack ice. We were 5 miles from the flow edge. It was just such a huge storm with 15-foot waves coming underneath the ice, and it's just, you can see the ice undulating. You know, like the 10-foot waves coming under the ice as it's bending. It's very supple because it's salty. And so then all of a sudden the wind stops, the current comes in, or the wind shifts, and all that ice is now breaking off, going up past Greenland and then down towards Newfoundland, you know, so in the big ocean currents. So you always have to monitor the ice that you're on, because it's always fracturing.
Do you have a satellite phone or something with you?
Yeah, I do. I have a satellite phone, and I only started carrying it recently, but 2 years ago, I was on a piece of ice that broke off, and that's the one I was 2 miles out to sea. I sent my team off to safety in their snowmobiles. I said, you go try and find land, or try and get to a jump from ice to ice. I'll stay with the airplane. And I phoned my editor at National Geographic, and I said, you know, I'm drifting out to sea, but don't worry, I'm with the airplane. And she said, you know, well, that's stupid. You know, why didn't you go to safety? Because the airplane was broken. We'd blown the engine in a flight. And so, yeah, it's always a balance. But we got rescued. They came back and got me in the plane.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Bill in Dallas says, I just looked at Mr. Nicklin's gallery on his website and I'm truly in awe of his work. How do you get the shots where the lower half of the photograph is submerged and the upper half is above the waterline?
That's a great question. It's a trick that I learned from David Dubelet, another photographer working at National Geographic. And the two tricks are here, you have to balance the focal plane and you have to balance the light. The above water is brighter than the underwater. So I'll use a two-stop or three-stop graduated neutral density filter, and that's a common filter that landscape photographers use to bring in the bright horizon with the foreground. You know, Galen Rowell used to use this filter a lot in his photography. So a lot of us started copying these techniques, and then after that you just have to use a really great depth of field, like f22 or f16, and that's the beauty of these new digital cameras now, that you can have just instantly change the ISO to like an ISO 800 without having that noise and grain in your picture, and still get that great depth of field that you can have to bring the two focal planes together.
Is it particularly challenging to get really good shots of ice itself?
Not really. I mean, I work with a lot of, you know, very experienced photographers at National Geographic will come up to me and say, I'm really stressed. I'm like, why? Well, because I got to go shoot this story on snow, and you know, I don't know what to do. And it's once that's mostly what I shoot. So I find it extremely easy to shoot ice. You start to understand there's such a different exposure range in ice. You know, ice that's blue is almost neutral gray. It's almost like shooting gray. It's so deep and dark. You can have ice that's black. So it's like photographing a black bear. So you have to really watch your exposure. But the trick with snow and ice and all this stuff now, it's the digital cameras are so amazing nowadays that you've got your histogram. And as long as you're putting your histogram in between the goalposts, you know, between the left and right, so you're not blowing out the highlights or losing the shadows, you try and, you know, you got to lose something, so you usually lose the shadows and never try and blow things out. And the new cameras are great, and so it's just look at the histogram. Don't get so caught up in staring at the LCD screen on the back of the camera. We call that chimping, where you look like a chimp. You look like a chimp, and you're staring, you're like, you know, scratching, you're patting yourself on the back and admiring your photos. But just look at the histogram and just keep working and just follow your eye and your vision.
Paul Nicklin is my guest. His new book is called Polar Obsession. You can see him speak tonight at the Brinker International Forum Lecture Series at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can check out his work online right now. There's a link to it on the Think page of KERA.org, or you can go directly to paulnicklin.com. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. National Geographic photographer Paul Nicklin is my guest. His new book is called Polar Obsession. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Jeremy in McKinney. Hey, Jeremy.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, please.
Hi, Paul. It's Jeremy Woodhouse here.
Oh, Jeremy Woodhouse. How are you?
Long time no hear.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell your audience that the first time I ever met Paul was on a Tundra buggy. I think it was in 1999, wasn't it?
97, I think.
Was it even that far back? My goodness. Paul was actually driving the Tundra buggy, so just shows what you can do if you have that sort of obsessive kind of drive, and look at where he's ended up now, top of his game, and one of my heroes, anyway, photographically.
That's very kind of you, Jeremy. I appreciate it. Yeah, no, back then it's really is about, you know, not having any money and being broke and doing what you can to get shots. So if I wanted to be with the Bears, I offered to drive the Tundra buggies for free, and that's how we got our shots. But I appreciate it.
What were you doing out there, Jeremy?
Are you signing books tonight?
Absolutely. We'll be signing books after the talk. And are you going to make it?
I've got a little six-year-old, and I've got to put him to bed first, so I'm not sure if I'll get there in time, but maybe I'll get there later. But I've got a book, and I want you to sign it, and I'll try and bring it down.
Sounds great. Look forward to seeing you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. I want to ask you about the photograph on the cover. It's really extraordinary. We see a polar bear, and we see a reflection of the same polar bear on the other side of it. Can you explain what it is exactly?
Sure, absolutely. I was very Yeah, it's a great story, Chris, because it's you know, sometimes with photography you get surprises, and you know, I wish I could say that I had drawn that picture and envisioned it completely and I got this shot, but it was this really large polar bear that was around my tent, and he was lingering around and he was starting to get into a little bit of trouble. And I hate to harass animals. In my photography, I like to really not change their behavior whatsoever. I want them to stay natural, and then you get better pictures. But he was being such a nuisance that we had to push him off the ice into the water to get him away from our camp before, you know, I didn't want an Inuit hunter to shoot him because he was being a problem bear. So now he's swimming in the water, and we have this tiny little boat that we got into with this engine that wasn't working very well. It was an 8-foot long little boat, and we just drove up beside him, and it was a perfectly glassy, calm day. There were all these chunks of ice in the fjord, and so we drove up beside him, and I leaned over the edge of the boat and just dunked my hands and my camera underwater and started shooting. And then he dove underwater, and I saw him dive, and I could see that his reflection was casting up on the surface, on the underside surface of the water. So the underside layer of the water is like a mirror, just the same as you would see a reflection of mountains on the top side of the water. So I started to use that as my palette or my canvas to try and get this shot, and I could see it happening. And I went wider on the lens, and I tilted it up a bit, and then he dove again and looked over at me. And then I was shooting film back then, and tragically that roll of film went into a Ziploc bag and went through two X-ray machines on the way home. Back from my home to get to the lab. Anyway, so when I got the film back a month later, didn't even think there would be anything on the picture that was worthwhile. And all of a sudden, there's the bear. The paws are perfect, and he's looking over at the camera. And there's a piece of ice up in the corner. And I was just really, you know, very happy with it. I think that's why I love the image so much, because it was better than I could ever had anticipated. And I had already written it off because of the X-ray machine. So I was quite pleased to get it.
Yeah, it appears to be suspended, basically in midair.
Right. It's just such a, you know, and the water is often not that clear there. And I didn't know how clear it was because I was just looking through the viewfinder. It was hard to see. But I was about from me to you. So I was less than 3 feet away from that bear when I took that picture on a really wide angle lens. So it is like he's just floating in space and the ice above him. And, you know, people talk about space being magical, but to me, the most magical place in the world is underwater. You still get that 3D environment where you're floating and you're weightless and suspended. But yet you've got all these beautiful palettes and lights and different shades of blue and all these, you know, animals and behavior. I think it's a really great place to be.
There's another shot in the book of something that I didn't know existed at the poles, and that is these really colorful sea anemones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was very surprised on that dive as well, because the Arctic is, especially the Arctic, is not known for being that rich in the underwater world, because it is so cold. So you don't have a lot of life like you say you do in British Columbia on the west coast of the U.S. where you've just got every rock is covered with marine life because the water is perfect. And that cold water, there's not that many nutrients. But when I dove under this cliff, it was under a breeding bird colony of over 500,000 birds. And I dove down, and I knew because of their feces defecating into the water that it would be this life cycle, this nutrient recycling, where the nutrients are falling into the ocean, and who's feeding on that? So I dropped down in the ocean, and I saw this wall from 10 feet deep below the surface to as deep as I could go, 120 feet plus in that cold water, and I could not ever find rock to put my fingers on because it was just so covered in life, feeding on the guano of these birds. So I was really excited to find that situation. And it's also a very high current area flushing through there, so it's flushing all these, basically force feeding all these nutrients to, you know, millions of sea anemones. So it was a very beautiful surprise again.
Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll speak to Lakshmi in Frisco. Hi, Lakshmi.
Hi, I have a question for your guest.
Hello.
I was watching Timothy Treadwell's documentary yesterday on Animal Planet, and what happened to Timothy was very tragic. I was wondering if you have ever prepared yourself for such encounters, or have you ever felt like that, you know, you're overconfident and like get too close to the animal when you're photographing, and, you know, have you prepared yourself for such kind of,
Is Timothy the gentleman who you're referring to in Alaska who was... He was attacked by the bear.
Yes,
yeah,
the grizzly bear.
Yeah, that was a very tragic event. But I have to honestly say, maybe it's my biologist training in me and being around animals since I was a kid. But animals give you a lot of signs when they're uncomfortable, when they don't want you around. And you have to really work with these animals and listen to them. And I saw that documentary on Timothy as well. And there were a lot of scenarios when the bears were telling him to back off, and he was just he was so in love with what he was doing. He was so emotional that he kept, you know, pushing these bears on on occasion. And I thought the bears were extremely tolerant, wonderful animals, and animals almost always are. And, you know, but it just takes one animal. And the thing that people don't understand, not all animals are the same. And there was, in fact, one leopard seal I came across near the end of the project, and she was huge again, and she was eating the carcass of a crab-eater seal, which was another huge seal. And her teeth were all broken. Her jaw was different. Morphologically, she looked different. When she opened her mouth at me and did this threat display, she actually hissed and made this noise. And that was the only seal I never got in the water with. And so you really have to be aware of everything. And when you realize that not all animals are the same, you can't walk up to a grizzly bear and say, well, that one accepted me, so they all will. You know, who knows what their experiences are. Maybe that bear has been shot or chased by helicopters. So I always let the animals dictate the encounter. If they don't want me around them, I give them space and leave them alone.
Talk for a minute about bowhead whales. I was stunned to read that they live 200 years.
Over 200. They're not exactly sure how old bowhead whales live, but they're saying 200, 250 years old. One of the oldest living animals on Earth right now.
How can you tell their age?
They're looking at the eyes. Mm-hmm. This is what the scientists have been doing. So they still hunt bowheads in Alaska. That population seems to be doing well. And the Inuit in the East Coast now are also hunting bowheads again because their population is slowly coming back. I question the numbers that the government's putting out, but so they're analyzing the age of the whales through their eyes.
How hard is it to get a photograph of a whale? Because you can't guess when they're going to surface, right?
Right. I mean, a lot of these pictures in the book, and that's what I'll talk about tonight at AT&T, is how hard it is to get these images. And it's, you know, I tried for 15 years to get one picture of a bowhead whale underwater. And finally, just 2 years ago, I had an incredible encounter where the water visibility was really bad. But somehow this whale came up to the surface right beside me. My assistant threw me back into the water. I was so cold I couldn't move from a previous dive. He threw me in, you know, and the whale, I guess he stirred up the water, but he basically created this pool of fresh water around him in the salt water. And he was in this perfect clear window. And I just clicked three times. He tried to push me with his chin gently, curious, and then he dove. And so, I mean, that's how I got that picture. I mean, and the bear on the cover, you know, it's 15 years of trying to get one good picture of a bear underwater, and the narwhals was trying every year for 10 years to get two good days with the narwhals. So it really is a labor of love to come back with these few little images of it's just so much work that goes into getting those pictures. Then there's leopard seals that want to feed you penguins all day long, and it's you know, not every situation is super challenging.
Is that patience that you have, is that born of a sort of inherent optimism, do you think?
Maybe. It's also, I just love being there. I mean, I cannot imagine, you talk about high-definition TV, you know, people want HD, they want that real-life experience, but it doesn't get any better than this. Again, you've got that vulnerability, a bit of fear, the adrenaline's going, the excitement of being there. And it's these encounters, honestly, one 20-minute encounter with a wild animal like that, especially these big-top predators, will keep me charged and excited for a whole year until I can get that fix again of being with them. So it's I don't know what it is. I love what I do.
Have you experimented with shooting video?
No, I'm scared to, because video is so...
That you're scared of.
I'm scared of it. I'm actually scared of cities, and I'm scared of traffic in cities. But I'm also... video is just so easy, and it's hard to do good video, but it's just, I mean, everything looks so clear and perfect in that screen. And what I do is, I'm a journalist and I tell stories in magazines, my pictures hopefully will live on forever, and my stories will live on forever, and they'll keep reaching people and let them know how important the sea ice is in the polar regions.
Let's go next on the phone to Russell in Dallas. Hey, Russell.
Hi, Paul. I was on the 2005 National Geographic Svalbard trip.
Yes.
And I have the same photo of the bear eating the whale.
Cool.
And which I was just amazed. And the question is, have you seen other things like that, or is that just one of a kind?
So you were on the National Geographic Lindblad expedition ship?
Yes.
So we were there. Yes. Oh, that's really cool. It's nice to meet you here again. That was a very, very rare encounter. And that's, you know, I think you have to be up there sort of all your life to realize, you know, you're sitting there, you and I are in our room sleeping, and you get a wake-up call over the PA saying there's a bear on the front, off the front bow, eating a whale, a beluga whale, and you go up there and you take your pictures and then you go back to bed. I mean, it's... And to have it to be so incredible, there were, what, five or six bears in that situation, and they moved off a little bit, and then that one skinny bear came in there and just fed in front of us, you know, 50 feet away from the ship for 2 hours. So it's one of the most incredible things I've ever seen from a ship situation. You know, I'd rather be alone in a Zodiac where you can work with that animal and be less intrusive. And well, the ship was actually really is a great platform for that. But then there's another shot in my book where I actually walked up 30 feet from a really big male feeding on a bearded seal. But it's that you have pictures of that, Russell, or cherish those, because it's one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my career photographing up in the Arctic.
Do you try to wear white to camouflage yourself?
Depends. Sometimes I wear white. If I'm going to go stealth, if I'm in a blizzard and maybe polar bears are walking by, and I, again, with all of my photography, I don't want to be intrusive. I don't want to change their behavior. I want them to act naturally, and that's how you get your best pictures. And so I'll wear white if I want the bear just to come walking by, you know, and not even know I'm there, or if it's hunting for seal. But if it's a situation where the bear already knows I'm there, and I want to get close to it, and I want it to come close to me, or whatever animal we're referring to, it's better to identify yourself. And the best way you can identify to an animal is to talk to it and to let it hear your voice. You know, because if I'm just walking right towards you, or if someone, you know, in Dallas at night on the street is walking right towards me, you don't know what their intentions are. But if they say to you, "Hey, stranger, how are you tonight?" all of a sudden you relax. And it's the same with an animal. If you say, you know, "Hey, you're a pretty bear," and you let it hear your voice, and you give a nice soothing voice, then it has a very calming effect on them.
Even if it has never seen or heard a human before, it sort of can read that?
I think so, because your body energy as well. If you know, I don't walk right towards the animal, I'll look off to the side, I'll look down at the ground, and I'll just talk very nicely to it, or I'll even turn my back on it and walk away a little bit and act like I'm bored or not interested in it, and it starts to relax. But as soon as you're nervous, your heart's racing, you direct your energy towards it, and you're like, "Hey, bear," you know, it's a totally different, you're giving off a totally different vibe than if you're just totally chilled, nonchalant, and act like you don't care or you're not scared. And again, you don't want to act scared and you don't want to act aggressive. Those are sort of the balance that you're always finding as of someone who's working close to these animals.
What qualities do you look for when you're choosing an assistant?
Wow. I wish some of my assistants would call in. I have a great friend, Sean Powell, lives in Austin, I just need someone who's tireless energy that are willing to work 20 hours a day, sometimes work 40 hours straight. My assistants have to be super fit. They have to be good divers. They have to be comfortable diving under the ice. They have to learn to love equipment, because I'm chaotic in the field. I've got, you know, 15 cameras and housings and, you know, 1,500 pounds of equipment. So they're always sort of following behind me, you know, cleaning up my mess. But at the same time, the best assistant is always a step ahead of me. You know, if the narwhals are coming, and they know that I want to shoot underwater, they're getting all that ready as the whales are coming. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, what picture do I want to make? The lights this way, you know, do I need a helicopter or a plane, or do I need to dive at this point? So I want them working with me, and they have to be very fit. They have to be willing to work extremely hard and work till complete exhaustion and eat really bad food and live in the cold and suffer. And that's what I look for in an assistant.
Hopefully they're well paid.
Yeah, I take very good care of my assistants.
National Geographic photographer Paul Nicklin's latest book is called Polar Obsession. He will be speaking tonight at the Brinker International Forum Lecture Series at the AT&T Performing Arts Center. You can find more about that appearance at attpac.org. Find Paul Nicklin's work at paulnicklin.com. Paul, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.